Again, it's very good to see all who are here. You're each one very warmly and heartily welcome at the meeting. Thank you for coming. Some are frequenters here and other meetings, nothing strange to you. Perhaps others are not so often here. So whatever category, whether you're a regular attender or just a visitor on this occasion or these occasions, we're glad to see you and make each one equally welcome in the Lord's name as we consider His word together. Remember the other nights still remaining through until Friday night, each evening at 8 o'clock, and we'll be glad to see you if you're free and able to make it. Now, we're still following some of these Bible 50s, and tonight we're into the book of Psalms, and our reading will involve Psalm number 50, the 50th Psalm of the book of Psalms. And again, we read the whole chapter together. A psalm of Asaph. The mighty God, even the Lord, hath spoken and called the earth from the rising of the sun unto the going down thereof. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God hath shined. Our God shall come, shall not keep silence. A fire shall devour before him, and it shall be very tempestuous round about him. He shall call to the heavens from above, and to the earth, that he may judge his people. Gather my saints together unto me, those that have made a covenant with me by sacrifice, and the heavens shall declare his righteousness, for God is judge himself. Selah. Hear, O my people, and I will speak, O Israel, and I will testify against thee. I am God, even thy God. I will not reprove thee for thy sacrifices or thy burnt offerings to have been continually before me. I will take no bullock out of thy house, nor he goats out of thy folds, for every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon a thousand hills. I know all the fowls of the mountains, and the wild beasts of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell thee, for the world is mine, and the fullness thereof. Will I eat the flesh of bulls, or drink the blood of goats? Offer unto God thanksgiving, and pay thy vows unto the Most High, and call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver thee, and thou shalt glorify me. But unto the wicked God saith, what hast thou to do to declare my statutes, or that thou shouldest take my covenant in thy mouth? Seeing thou hatest instruction, and castest my words behind thee, when thou sawest a thief, then thou consentest with him, and hast been partaker with adulterers. Thou givest thy mouth to evil, thy tongue frameth deceit. Thou sittest and speakest against thy brother. Thou slanderest thine own mother's son. These things hast thou done, and I kept silent. Thou thoughtest that I was altogether such an one as thyself, but I will reprove thee and set them in order before thine eyes. Now consider this, ye that forget God, lest I tear you in pieces, and there be none to deliver. Whoso offereth praise glorifieth me, and to him that ordereth his conversation aright will I show the salvation of God. Now that's all the reading we take just now. We trust the Lord's blessing upon His Word. Now, as I say, we're following these 50s, and tonight we are moving into the book of Psalms. Those who were able to be present last night know that we were reading in the book of Genesis, a chapter from the Law. Now we're moving into the next major section of the Old Testament, and it's a chapter from Psalms. There is a 50th chapter in the prophets, in the prophecy of Jeremiah, but we don't just have enough nights to consider that chapter. An interesting and far-reaching chapter it is. It's very common and well known by many of us just to think about the outline of the Old Testament, often repeated and rehearsed, but it'll just give us a little bit of context for where we are right now. We have the 17 books of history at the beginning of the Old Testament, from Genesis right through to Esther. Then we have the 17 books of prophecy at the end of the Old Testament, from Isaiah to Malachi. And here, sandwiched in between, we have just a little cluster, 5 books of poetry. And a most interesting collection it is. And interesting that God has been pleased to communicate to us through the narrative of history and through the predictions of prophecy and also through the rhyme and the rhythm of poetry. Every part of the Old Testament, it has a voice to us and reaches us in different ways. The books of history are really for our education, telling us where we have come from, how the earth has been created, how history has developed, and how we have arrived where we are. And all of that is a very important education, the books of history. The books of prophecy are books of expectation. They're not telling us where we have come from, they're telling us where we are going. And we put the telescope of prophecy to our eye and we peer into the heretofore unseen future, and God tells us things that are yet to be. And in between these two, having learnt where we have come from and having learnt where we are going, we have these 5 books of poetry, and they're dealing with experience, just the experience of life, and quite a variegated experience it is. And that's why it's poetry. Poetry is, it's not like prose, it's not like common text. Poetry is that form of language that opens a window into the soul, gives us a vent to express our feelings. And there's a colour and a metaphor and a simile and a warmth and a range of feeling expressed in poetry that can never be expressed just in straightforward narrative. So we have these 5 books touching upon the experiences, the varied experiences of life. Book of Job, here the book of Psalms. As far as chapters are concerned, it's the longest book in the Bible with its 150 chapters. Then the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon. The book of Job tells us about the mysteries of life. A righteous man, good man, not the likes in all the earth, and yet look at what he suffered. Still a puzzling mystery. Why good people suffer and suffer so severely. The mysteries of life. That's one of the strange experiences of human existence. When we get to the book of Proverbs, it's the maxims of life. And for the management of life, a book of wisdom. And those short little proverbs that put a maximum of truth into a minimum of terms. And they give us some idea how to manage our lives and different areas of life, our words and our wealth and our works and our ways and our wives. All of those things are covered so carefully and comprehensively in the book of Proverbs. When we get to the book of Ecclesiastes, of course it's just the maze of life. Some strange things in Ecclesiastes. The race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the strong. Some of the most wicked people live into senior days. Righteous people die young sometimes. And there's a whole muddle, and there's a maze in life that can hardly be unravelled. And the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes, in his poetry, he grapples with all of that. All is vanity and vexation of spirit. Then, of course, once we get to the Song of Solomon, it's the matrimony of life. The beautiful poetry of the Song of Solomon, telling us about the elevation of pure love, expressed intimately within the context of sanctified marriage, and all of that so precious and so wonderful. Another aspect of life's experience. When we're here, just right here in the book of Psalms, we're thinking about the music of life. These 150 Psalms, they move along the whole scale of music. Songs and sighs, and sorrows and sobs. That's why so many people come to the Psalms, love the Psalms.
It's almost a psalm that would just fit into every situation of life. And so we're constantly referring to the book of Psalms in life's experiences. The brightest days and the blackest days, and every kind of day in between, is found reflected somewhere in these 150 Psalms. And even though they're written millennia ago, we can identify with them. You know, human emotions and human experience hasn't really changed very much. Although we live in the computer age, in the age of sophisticated technology, the deep-seated elements of human personality and the spiritual and emotional and psychological needs of human beings are still the same. That's why we can reach back into a book like this and we can say, that's just how I feel. That's just where I am. And that poet has just expressed what I wouldn't be able to put into words. And the groanings of my heart he has put into vocabulary. And you get the full range, the full octave of just different notes and different music of life here in this book of Psalms. We have just read one of the Psalms tonight, Psalm number 50, just in connection with our present study of 50s. And I think I'll just mention maybe four things about this psalm that will be sufficient for the present occasion. First of all, I'll say something about the supper of this psalm. It is provided, especially one verse that I highlight just in a minute. And this psalm has provided great supper for the Lord's people in some of the difficulties of life. The supper of this psalm. Secondly, I'll say something to you about the singer, or the scribe, if you like, of the psalm. It's a psalm of Asaph. Do you know anything about Asaph? The Bible tells us quite a bit about him. An interesting character he was, and he filled a very special role in the ancient ceremonies of the Old Testament. So the singer on this occasion was Asaph. We mentioned some of the other psalms that this man also wrote, or at least administered in some way or another. Then I have to say something very specially about the substance of the psalm. It's a psalm of judgment. God himself, it says, is judge. Tell you, that's a big thing. God himself. And it's looking forward to a day when God himself will take in hand this guilty globe on which we live. And the unchecked evil of earth will come under the surveillance and the sentence of his righteousness. I tell you, God himself is judge, and he has never abdicated his throne, and he has never surrendered his righteousness, and he has never reduced his standards. And this world has yet to see the horrors and the terrors of the day when God as judge will deal with men in the saturation of their sin and their secularism and their atheism and all kinds of iniquity. So the substance of the psalm, it will be interesting just to take a little look at that when we get to it. And we'll see how the time goes. I might be able to say something about the sequence of the psalm, because it belongs to a series here, and we'll see what we make of that. First of all, the supper of this psalm. I'm thinking especially of verse number 15. And this is a verse that has touched the heart and entered into the experience of many of the Lord's people. It tells us, call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver thee, and thou shalt glorify me. There are many believers, and they have clung to that verse, and they have turned it over in their mind, and they have put it into practice, and they have called upon the Lord in days of trouble, and they have been delivered, and they have lived to praise him and to express their gratitude to him. Maybe we could recommend it to us all tonight, just to use this verse, to make it a kind of a pattern verse. You know, there's pressure in the verse, call upon me in the day of trouble. Not every day in life is a day of trouble, but there are days of trouble. Days when things are tight. In fact, that's the literal meaning of the word trouble. It's an old Hebrew term that means something that's very very restricted, something that's straight, something that is narrow. Narrow was one of the translations of the basic word. Remember that story of Balaam? And he was coming along on his donkey, and he went, and the angel of the Lord stood in front of him, and he wouldn't stop. And the old donkey turned into a field. Then come on a little bit further to the valley of the vineyards, and there was a place where there were two walls. And again, the angel of the Lord blocked the way, and Balaam didn't want to stop, and the old donkey, to try and get past, pushed his foot against the wall. Then they came to a third place, and it says there was a narrow place. That's our word. There was a narrow place in which one could not turn to the right or to the left. Jammed in. Anybody here tonight in a narrow place? Any believer just come this Tuesday night and you're under pressure? Things have closed you in. And to be honest, you just don't know what way to turn. No matter what direction you look, you can see nothing but problems and more problems. And in your life, just this Tuesday, whatever it is, the 14th of April, just this Tuesday, it's a day of trouble. It's a day of pressure. It's a day when you have come up almost against the dead end and you can't go any further and there's not much room for escape. That happens. Sometimes because of health problems, sometimes because of employment, sometimes because of family vexation. All of those things. Life doesn't go through smooth. The experience of life, dear Christians, is a very, very variegated education. What do you do? Well, he says, when you get to the left or to the right, he says, look up. And he says, in the pressure, pray. And he says, when there's no human help that can relieve the stress and the strain of your straitened situation, he says, lift your heart to God in prayer and let your soul reach above the ceiling of your circumstances, right to God. Call upon me. Maybe there's a Christian, you say it's very simple. It's very simple advice. There's nothing very super spiritual about it. No, maybe not. But I tell you, it's something that sometimes we can overlook. We try to manage our own situation. And we try to cope. And we like to be in control. There are times when you can't be in control. And there are times when things close in so tight that you know you're beaten. And your normal and natural resources, management resources, they're out beyond their capacity. And the only alternative you're left with is to, in total dependence and expectation. So in the pressure, he says, learn what it means to pray. Call upon me. It's accompanied with a promise. He said, call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you. He may not necessarily take away the trouble. But he could deliver you. Deliver you from caving in. Deliver you from crumbling. Deliver you from internal and emotional collapse. God can still deliver his people in what seems to be impossible situations. And I say in this text, in pressure, many saints down the ages have turned in humble prayer, called upon the Lord, plied his sanctuary with their problems. He has delivered them in unusual ways, not always just what we might expect. And then following the pressure and the prayer and the promise, he said, there'll be praise. Thou shalt glorify me. He said, you'll be able to look back. And when you see my hand in the texture of life's experience and see how I have delivered and strengthened and supported and helped, he said, you'll be left with no alternative but just to praise me. And you'll say, well, when I was at the end of my resources and I clung to the Lord and he gave me strength which I thought I could never have and enabled me to carry burdens that I thought I would never be able to bear and enabled me to lift up my head when it should have been bowed down like a bulrush and I see what the Lord has done, and I've experienced His sufficient and supporting grace, I just lift my heart in thanksgiving unto Him. A small recipe right here in Psalm number 54 for just Christians in pressure and distress. I mentioned quickly in that connection the supper of the Psalms. It's good to find supper. Sometimes we maybe can overuse them. I was hearing there a while back about a brother went to visit an older sister, a respected sister. She'd been ill for quite a while in nursing care, and just before he left, he said, I'll read you a verse, and that's all right, and pray. It had a nice conversation. Oh, she said, that'd be very good. No, it's not Psalm 23. She said, I've heard enough of it. But at least she was honest. She was honest. And she just told the truth. She thought she'd heard Psalm 23 just repeated. You know, we can repeat things. You see. And this is not just a quick fix. This is the reality. The reality of exhausted human resources. The reality of an inexhaustible divine reservoir. And the connection of prayer that makes a conduit from the throne of heaven into the soul of my experience. And I was reading there one day, there was a man who wrote a book on the Psalms. His name was Gavely, A.C. Gavely. He was a servant of the Lord back, I think he died about 1945 or somewhere thereabouts, North America, German by extraction, preached, wrote just an endless array of books still avidly read to this present day, and well worth reading. And this book on the Psalms is very interesting. A man who greatly majored in Bible prophecy, and he grasped some of the prophetic significance of the Psalms that I'm mentioning just in a minute. And he says in his comment on this Psalm, he said this verse 15 was the first verse that he learned as a child. Strange verse, maybe, to teach a child. Call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver thee. Thou shalt glorify me. And he said, even though it was the first verse that he learned as a child, he said he has carried it with him throughout his whole life. And he says, the longer I live, the bigger the verse becomes. Isn't it great to see a verse of the Bible getting bigger as life goes on? And the verse becomes so part and parcel of your experience, it takes on magnified meaning. That's what it really means. And the second reference that I'll make, just very briefly, some of you were there to hear it, I wasn't privileged to be present, but just last week, or thereabouts in the Easter conference, Mr. Sam Patterson, I had a contact from him, was it yesterday, but he read this very same verse. Many here know the difficulties that Brother Sam has had health-wise in the past few years. And what has sustained him and strengthened him and supported him through very, very cramping and curtailing circumstances and a serious battle with cancer is just the words of verse 15. Call upon me in the day of trouble. Maybe tomorrow will be your day of trouble. Maybe it'll be mine. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver thee. Not necessarily cancel the trouble. I will deliver thee, and thou shalt glorify me. So, thank God for supper, genuine supper, spiritual supper, that we can find from some of these great texts. I'll say a little bit about the singer, this man Asaph. One of the great accomplishments that was done by King David, that's not that often spoken about. We hear the story of his killing of the giant, and some of those other great exploits of David. He was the sweet singer, the sweet psalmist of Israel. And one of the things that he did, he organized 4,000 singers. We read about all this in the first book of Chronicles, and other references that are made as well. In the service of the ancient temple, and the tabernacle and leading into the temple, there were a number of priests, and then there were 4,000 praisers. And then there were 4,000 porters. And King David organized the 4,000 singers that were to be involved in the temple service. And he arranged them under three great leaders. leaders of those Levitical choirs, and they stood with their various instruments and they praised the Lord. One of the leaders was this man Asaph, perhaps the primary leader. Another man called Jeduthun or Ethan, and another man called Heman. Those three men, in a very, very remarkable way, they conducted the praises of Israel. Asaph's name means gather. In fact, that's the very word that's used here, gather. My people together, that have made together the saints together, that have made a covenant. That's the verb Asaph. Asaph means a gatherer. Jeduthun means praising. Heman means faithful. And these three men, they were gathering together the faithful praising of the Lord's people 1,000 years BC. And across the skies of Israel, there rang songs of praise as a result of King David and his organization of the singer. If you'd been around Jerusalem in those days, your heart would have been charmed to hear just the atmosphere filled with the loud praises of the God of Israel. And they did it night and day, 24/7. And they did it on a rota basis. And they had different turns. And no matter what time of the day or night you would have gone to the ancient temple in Jerusalem, there would have been the sweet sound of songs of praise. You know, I think we just need to keep in mind that God is a God who loves the praises of his people. We are expected to be a singing people. Say, dear people, isn't it great to be saved? We're on our way to heaven. We're in relationship with God. We are the people who have higher hopes now that we're linked with a risen Christ. Members of the body of Christ. Called to share and be the bride of Christ. If there's any people on earth that should be a singing people, we should be a singing people. 'Tis we, O Lord, whom thou hast shown the deadly bitterness of sin. We who forgiving love have known may fitly bring thank offerings in. This man, Asaph, I say, was the leader, the lead singer, and the organizer and the teacher. You don't need to turn to it, but I'll just read a verse from Chronicles. Just you listen to this verse. It says, David and the captains and so on, they organized the sons of Asaph, who prophesied according to the order of the king. Then it speaks about Jeduthun, the man Jeduthun. And it says about him, he prophesied with a harp to give thanks and to praise the Lord. And it says then about Heman, all these under the hands of their fathers with psalteries and so on, they prophesied according to the king's order to Asaph, Jeduthun and Heman. So that in their songs, this is the point I want to make just now, in their songs there was prophecy. Of course, we don't have the musical instruments. Now we're not making music with an instrument. Now, in this era where the Holy Spirit has come, we are making melody in our hearts. But as far as those ancient days were concerned, they had musical instruments, but they weren't just there to entertain. That was never the intention. He says, in the songs which these men composed, they were uttering prophecy. And that's a whole side of things that perhaps has not been emphasized as much as it could have been or should have been. That in the Psalms, in these great songs, in this hymn book of Israel, there was teaching that was being communicated. They weren't just singing meaningless ditties. They just weren't repeating threadbare little sentences. They were actually preaching, and they were teaching, and they were prophesying about the future in these great songs that they composed. All I'm saying is just this. We live in a day where great emphasis is placed upon music teams and music leader. And great emphasis is placed upon entertainment. And you go to many places where they call themselves Christian, and a place like this would just be littered with drums and all kinds of instruments that belong to an obsolete dispensation. do not belong to this dispensation. There's nothing Christian about them. And people want to know just what kind of a music team they have. And that great entertainment that engages people. That never, I say kindly, was God's intention. Even in the Old Testament, when there was instruments of music, the songs were written to teach the people and to prophesy. And when you come to the New Testament, the Apostle Paul says, you would sing to yourselves with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, teaching and admonishing one another. He said, even in the songs that you sing, you don't sing them just for impression. And you don't just sing them for professionalism. He said, you sing those songs to teach and admonish one another. So this man, Asaph, I think I have to leave it there and say nothing more about him. You investigate some more things connected with him, because he's a fascinating character in the Old Testament. That'll do for the singer. Now, what about the substance of this great psalm? And as I say, it's looking forward to a future day. This is the prophecy. These men were prophesying in their psalm. And looking forward to a future day that hasn't yet arrived, when the Lord would come, and when, as I've already emphasized, God himself would be judged. The first thing in the substance of the psalm that I want to emphasize is just the strange calm. And to get the meaning of the psalm, I think you have to start at the end. And there God speaks about the sins that men have committed. And he said, these things you have done. And he said, I kept silent. It was just as if heaven never looked. God never did anything. He never intervened. Sinning human beings and a silent heaven. And it's a great mystery. You know, I often have read, and you have read it too, one of the great works of the English language and of books of Christian exposition is Sir Robert Anderson's The Silence of God. And the very first sentence of that book in chapter 1 is this: a silent heaven is the greatest mystery of our existence. Mind you, in that one sentence is wrapped up just a depth of profound meaning. A silent heaven. Men seem to get away with it unchecked. There's not even a clap of thunder. There's not even the appearance of a grey cloud. And some of the most reckless and ruthless acts of wanton, rampant wickedness are committed in this world. God never seems to blink. The strange calm of a silent heaven, while people sin and people suffer in this world, it's a mystery. Mr. Anderson, you know, he was involved in the judicial system, and Mr. Anderson goes on in that very chapter, he speaks about the persecution of Christians. Some of the finest believers that ever lived, hunted, pulled apart limb from limb by wild beasts under the Roman Empire, Armenia and other places. What about the martyrs at the stake? Men that bore faithful testimony to Christ in very, very challenging situations, paid the ultimate price, shed their blood, hung suspended at the stake unflinchingly, surrounded by wicked men that jeered and gloated in their suffering. Heaven never said a word. The strange calm of a silent heaven. Even the world that we live in today. Think of all the things that are being perpetrated. And all the evil. And all the twisted things that are carried up even at the highest level of society. Not to speak of the lowest level. And the variety. And the violence. And the vice. And the volume of human wickedness. We're not talking about a little bit of a crime done here and something done away over there in Australia and another one in Alaska. There's just blatant, brazen evil in every country, continent, culture in this world. and it's going on daily. And there's a cry of injustice rising heavenward, and there's not a mute. These things hast thou done, and I kept silence. Many of you have read Elie Wiesel's little or book, famous book, very impactful book, The Night. Holocaust survivor, philosopher, brilliant man, Nobel laureate winner, and all of those things. And that book he tells about the procession that they had to walk past three Jews that were being executed, two men and a boy. And I don't want to give the graphic details, for somebody would faint here. And they were all made to find that. The two men hung, died. The boy didn't die. His body wasn't heavy enough to do the job. You know what I mean? And as they walked past and filed past and saw these two lifeless forms hanging, and this boy in Auschwitz hanging, still his tongue out and still wriggling in his body, tortured with pain, all to satisfy the gratuitous lust of a moral monster. And as Elie Wiesel walked by, he heard a voice, he heard the man behind him saying, "Where's God? Where's God?" I'm not sure if you heard that down at the back. Where is God? Justice, grotesque exhibition of injustice and wanton cruelty. Where is God? 6 million of them heard into the gas chamber, part of God's own chosen people. Heaven silent. Maybe heaven silent in your experience. Leaving Auschwitz, coming closer. Maybe there's a believer here tonight that you have prayed, just like Habakkuk prayed. He said, "O Lord, how long shall I cry and thou shalt not answer?" He says, "Lord, I have bombarded your throne with earnest petitions." And he says, "I've never even received a single reply." And how long? It goes on. Job, what I've already referred to, he said in his awful suffering, just sitting there upon his ice, he says, I just wish in the midst of my extremity, he said, it would greatly relieve the pain that I'm suffering, if only God would give me a few sentences of explanation. But he says, I go back and I can't see him, and I go forward and I can't find him, and I go to the left and I go to the right, and he said, I can't. And he said, I wish I could come to his throne and I would just get an answer, if God would only speak and explain why this has happened to me. I've lived long enough to meet Christians just in that situation. Why did it happen to your family? Why us? Why now? At this stage in life, there's not a word that's being spoken. And so I'm just emphasizing for a minute, in different contexts in life, whether we think of the large world of political injustice, whether we think about the private suffering of some of the Lord's faithful people, and there doesn't seem to be any divine intervention. And I know it would make it easier for you if God would only explain. Listen, dear Christian, I say this. Faith doesn't live on explanations. Faith lives on promises. You might live for 70 years and never get an explanation. But in the absence of one explanation, God has given you 1,000 promises. And we have talked about one of them tonight. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you. Thou shalt glorify me. So that in the difficulties, in the darkness, in the silence, this strange calm, men seem to... And it's not only a mysterious silence, it's misunderstood. If you were speaking to men in the world, they would have their own idea, because they think God's silent because he's ignorant, doesn't even know. Some even deny that he exists. Others that think that there might be a God, some kind of a force, or some kind of a person out there. He doesn't know what's going on earth. He's so distant and detached, he's ignorant. Others will say, well, if he does know, he's just absolutely indifferent. And that's worse. They would say he knows, but he sits up in heaven in the calm and comfort of heaven, and he lets us sweat and suffer here, and he does nothing about it. He's either ignorant or he's indifferent. And then a third group will say he must be impotent. He maybe knows, and he cares, and would, but he hasn't the power to change it. And so this very, very mysterious silence is misrepresented and misunderstood by men in the world at large. And because sentence is not executed against an evil word, the heart of the sons of men is fully set. You know, it's amazing, dear Christians. It's amazing the hubris, or what's the word for it? The arrogance, the pride that men have in their evil. Unstoppable. And there seems to be no bounds. We live, thankfully, we live in a fairly sheltered environment. But the depth and the depravity and the degree of wickedness in this big world that we live in is quite shocking. And all of that makes it strange. The strange, the sudden coming. Now we're back to the beginning of the psalm. And we get the answer to this dilemma, because the psalm begins, "The mighty God, the Lord, hath spoken." Verse 3, "Our God shall come and not keep silent." There is a day, according to this psalm, when this silence will be shattered, and the calm will be changed, and the God who's been so quiet, and this mysterious, misunderstood silence, that's actually very merciful. We're glad for the silence. I'm glad, and you're glad, dear Christians, that God didn't come down with a heavy hand of judgment in this world 40 days after the world put his son on the cross. The long suffering of our God is salvation. This breathing space, this pause, has given us an opportunity to benefit from the death of Christ and to repent and to receive God's mercy. But it will soon be over, and the period of silence, the mighty God will speak. Talk about God not having power. I say his coming, our God shall come. His coming will be powerful. And he'll come surrounded by a tempest of fire. And he'll call heaven and earth as his witnesses. And he'll make this whole cosmos his courtroom. And his coming, it will be public, and it will be powerful, and it will be cunable. He will come with all the arsenal that it will take to execute righteous judgment. And there will not be a sin. I'm reaching forward even to the great white throne. But this is thinking of judgment upon earth. When God executes his judgment, there will not be a single sin unaccounted for. And the silence that men have thought so strange, God's righteousness will be established, and our good. The Apostle Paul speaks about this in slightly different but comparable language in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He speaks about the Lord Jesus. He'll be revealed from heaven with fire, flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel. And all of that kind of thing, just reaching forward to a solemn day of judgment when God will appear in this world, intervene in human history in a very, very clear, he's shining out of Zion. There's another wonderful prophecy. You see, will the very focus of this great courtroom scene be Zion, the city of Jerusalem? Yes, of course. Out of Zion, the city of Jerusalem. That's the very city to which the Lord will come back. When he comes back to execute vengeance, he will make the city of Zion, the place where he died, the place where his blood was shed to provide salvation, and the world that has rejected him, it's right at that place that he will establish the center of his court. And radiating out from Zion, there will be blazing righteousness shining forth, and the whole world will come for scrutiny and come for assessment. a sudden cut. The Spirit cometh.
Oh, she's another woman, judge. But he said, even though the strange camp will be shattered by the sudden coming of the Lord in judgment and in righteous vengeance, he said there'll be a Spirit company. And he said they'll be gathered into safety. They're his safe. He says they'll be saved. They'll be secure. Gather my saints together, them that have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. And that we are glad. I think that in the context, this is referring to Jews that will be saved in a coming day. They'll be gathered to safety. Thank God we'll be gathered to safety before that. We'll be gathered to the earth. But there will be a great gathering of saints that will be spared. You say, how come that any will ever be spared? Sure, they're all sinners. Well, he said, I tell you, these people who are saints, they have a relationship with me on the basis of sacrifice. He says, that's how they'll be sheltered. He says, the judgment which they deserve is a judgment that has already been absorbed by the sacrifice. And they have accepted that sacrifice, and they're in the good of covenant relationship with myself, and their sins forgiven. And he said, that company, that great company will be spared. It's good to know, dear, that while God's judgment will be divine and dreadful, it will not be indiscriminate. It will be righteous, and he will make very clear differences. You say, well, when he judges these people that are in the psalm who have been sinners, and just imagine that God didn't care and they went on sinning and they never had a thought of repenting or changing. He said, what kind of sins? Specific charges. The most of the psalm, I'm not going into it tonight, the most of the psalm is dealing with specific charges, and mainly two. He speaks about those who are, I'll call them formalists. And they've gone through all the rituals and the reality of offering sacrifices. And they live as they like, but they offer sacrifices to God more or less to bribe. They have to keep them quiet. We give them sacrifice. He says, I don't need your sacrifice. He says, I'm not hungry. He says, I'm not looking for your gift. He says, don't bring your books to bribe me. He said, I'm not to be bribed. He said, the cattle of 1,000 hills are mine. He said, I don't need your bullets to increase my stock a little bit or to satisfy my hunger. He said, listen, I'm not really interested in your gifts. He says, what I was really interested in was your godliness. He said, I didn't want your formality. I wanted your reality. He said, I'm not concerned about people that go through the motion. And the mechanics of religion. And they're always there. And they're doing the right things. And they're pressing the right buttons. And they know the rules to keep. But their hearts are not really pure and holy and genuine. He said, their piety is only skin deep and show. He says, listen. He says, for you formalists. He says, I want reality. Not just ritual. And I suppose, dear Christians, we could hear a voice of that too. Sometimes we can go through the motions and just the mechanics. And we have to ask ourselves, is there any reality? Is there any depth? Does this outward ceremony reflect something? And then he speaks about the hypocrites. Oh, he says, you're a good preacher. He said, you take my words in your mouth. You could repeat the law. As a Jew could. You could repeat the law. But he says, you don't keep the law. He says, you can repeat it to others. But he says, behind backs, he says, you're agreeing with thieves. You're the most covetous people that ever were known. And yet you can repeat the law, thou shalt not covet. And he said, you're grasping. And he said, you partake on the side of the adulterer. He said, you live double life. And he said, with your mouth you use gossip. And you slander your own brother and your own relation. He said, you're sending poisoned emails and all that kind of thing. He said, listen. He said, I'm not interested. He said, I don't want your ritual. I want your reality. He said, I don't want your preaching. He said, I want your practice. Sins of mind, you thought. Sins of mouth, you gossiped and you slandered. Sins of morality, you committed adultery
and you dabbled in promiscuity. He said, all of that, he said, was totally unacceptable to me, and all the while you were preached, we need to be careful about that. I'm amazed. I was just at a place there, and I should maybe mention this, a short time ago, and the brethren were telling me about, the brethren were giving a report, they weren't telling me, it was a public report. It wasn't recorded. And I'm not rehearsing it on duty, I'll not even tell you where the country was. But it was, there were two assemblies, planted, quite prosperous. And the two of them had to be closed down. Because in each case, the man who preached was having covert relationships that were unclean. Preaching, and yet living with adulterers and an adultery. And the assemblies had to be closed. You say, well, that's a bit over the top. I know, I hope it is. But all I'm saying, dear Christians, we can get a message from that. Not just ritual. Reality. And not just preaching. We can tell everybody how to live. That's good. Tell everybody how to live and how to live according to the Bible. That's good. Stand here and preach and tell them all how to behave. The question is, how are you living yourself? He said, all that sham and that show. He said, I'm going to tear away all the masquerading veneer. He said, I will judge. A very searing, searching, scrutinizing, solemn day of judgment. So the strange calf, the sudden coming, the spurred community of sins, the very searching charges. And he does give, just in the psalm, he does give very serious counsel. He says, consider them. He says, consider them. And he says, I want to tell you, if you change your ways, and you consider, and you change, and you convert, he says, I'm glad to tell you, you can experience the salvation of God. He says, I'm happy. I'm happy to do business with people that are genuine. That's why the next psalm, and I'm going to draw the line out, I would love to have shown you the sequence of psalms from Psalm 40. Right through to Psalm number 52. But that'll have to do for another night. Another night. That's why the next psalm, after this solemn exhibition of judgment, the prophecy of coming judgment, a solemn, I tell you, it is solemn, dear Christians. And we need to think that this is the God with whom this world has to do. This is the God whom we represent. This is the God of absolute intrinsic holiness, inflexible righteousness. This is the God who is standard. And these standards should be upheld here in the house of God. No gossip. No slander. No formality. No hypocrisy. No duplicity. No cheating on my marriage. None of these things. In God's house, these standards should be compatible and upheld according to the God who we represent. And the next psalm, in light of dreadful, serious, solemn, searching judgment, in Psalm number 50. That's why Psalm number 51 begins. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to the multitude of thy tender mercies. It's good to know, dear Christians, we have a God, despite all these solemn days of judgment that are coming, we have a God who shows mercy. We have a God who dispenses salvation. Well, maybe sing that verse, if I can find it in a minute here. Maybe sing that verse as we think of the day of judgment. Think of the fulfillment of Psalm 50. Think of the searing heat of divine flames and the fires of judgment. O awful day, who would not be sheltered, O Lamb of God? And thank God we have found the next psalm. Psalm 51 speaks about the joy of thy salvation. Dear Christians, thank God we're not heading to judgment. We're glad tonight we have the joy of salvation. We have enjoyed, appreciated the sacrifice. We are in covenant relationship with God through the sacrifice of his own Son at Calvary. We will not be gathered to judgment thank God, we will be gathered to glory. May God enable us to have lives that will reflect something of the holiness and the greatness of the God who we seek to serve. Shall we pray?